This week on New York Now, a look back at an anti-Semitic incident that rocked the state in the 1920s. Judicial officials are pushing a plan to streamline New York's complex court system. And we'll have analysis of this week's headlines on the Reporters Roundtable. I'm Ray Suarez, and this is New York Now.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET. Winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program, this is New York Now.
Welcome to New York Now. I'm Ray Suarez. New York State is set to start issuing driver's licenses to immigrants next week without requiring proof of legal residence. The Trump administration called the new law legally suspect and filed a brief in the case of Rensselaer County Clerk Frank Merola to help block the law from taking effect. Several other county clerks have said they may not comply with the new law as well, including Erie County Clerk Michael Kearns. We'll have more headlines coming up later in the show on the Reporters Roundtable. But first, in the fall of 1928, a four-year-old girl went missing from the northern New York village of Messina. Rumors that she had been kidnapped and killed by Jews as part of an alleged blood libel ritual soon spread. It thrust the small community into the national spotlight during a contentious presidential race. Today, anti-Semitic incidents account for the majority of the reported hate crimes in the state. That's according to data from the State Division of Criminal Justice Services. Casey Seiler of the Times Union joins me now. He recently spoke to author and NYU history professor Edward Berenson. Berenson's written a book about the incident and its impact on the state then and now. Casey, welcome. It's hard to think of a place as tiny and out of the way as Messina as making national news. Set the stage for us in the late 1920s.
Well, you have to imagine that this is just about the most rural part of the state. It is literally just below the Canadian border at the extreme northern border of New York. It was a community, Messina, that was beginning to, in fact, industrialize a little bit. There was a significant plant up there, and there was a small but vibrant Jewish community. Needless to say, it was a time in our country's life riven by politics. Al Smith was the Democratic presidential nominee running against Herbert Hoover, the Republican. At the time, the Klan was resurgent across the land. The Klan had targeted Al Smith. And into this kind of hothouse political atmosphere, not too dissimilar from our partisan era today, comes this very, very bizarre incident where essentially the Jews of Messina are accused or questioned about whether or not they had a role to play in the disappearance of this young girl.
That phrase, blood libel, still manages to send shivers down the spine. It's sort of a recasting of a medieval European anti-Semitic trope that actually uses blood to make matzah around Passover time. It's a crazy story, but one that still had motive power in the 20th century.
And unfortunately continues to have motive power. As Edward Berenson, the author, told us, you can go to websites today where the blood libel continues to be treated as if it's some kind of, you know, natural world historical fact. It is not. It's completely made up. We are, of course, talking, as you noted, at a time when anti-Semitic incidents are once again on the rise. We're talking only a couple of days after this horrible shooting in New Jersey at a kosher market that was carried out by people who believe many of the same goony anti-Semitic tropes that that came to play in Messina.
Well, Casey, let's go to your interview with Professor Berenson.
The initiating incident in your book, The Accusation, is the disappearance of four-year-old Barbara Griffiths in Messina, New York, in September 1928. The type of event that occurs probably, unfortunately, every city, every town across the nation all the time. When did the official response to this disappearance kind of go off the rails?
Took about 12 hours or so, and so Barbara disappeared in the late afternoon, we think 4 or 5 p.m., and the next morning, the officials of the town, the mayor and the police chief, called the rabbi into town and leveled the accusation of ritual murder.
So what was Messina's social makeup in the fall of 1928 in terms of, you know, ethnic makeup, religious?
Messina is a little town that had changed dramatically after the turn of the 20th century. 19th century, rural, agricultural, but because of the St. Lawrence River and the hydroelectric power, Alcoa opened an aluminum plant there in 1902. That changed the character of the town completely, and so all of a sudden you needed a large labor force. Labor force wasn't there in Messina, and so immigrant workers were recruited right off the boat in Ellis Island, but also across the border in Quebec. It had been an entirely Protestant town, people mostly from the same parts of Northern Europe, and pretty suddenly you had a large population of Catholics and Jews, and I think that's produced a lot of conflict. It was sort of a microcosm of the United States as a whole.
Your book goes deep into the history of the blood libel. These days, I think, except for people who kind of spend a lot of time in this kind of swampier parts of the internet, most people might not know about it. Can you give sort of a capsule description of where it came from and what exactly it is?
Yeah, so the blood libel, or the accusation of ritual murder, comes out of England from the 1100s. And the idea is that Jews need for their rituals, their religious rituals, to capture the blood of Christian children. And so the idea got to be that Jews kidnap children, torture them, stick them in barrels with spikes, and alive, pierce them and collect their blood in vessels. And later on, the idea got to be that Jews need the blood to make matzah and Passover. It's an insane idea. Obviously, no one has ever seen any Jewish person do anything like this, but it's an idea that just sunk deeply into European culture.
So to bring all of this, centuries of European history and prejudice and what have you, back to Messina, this possibility, this accusation, to borrow the title of your book, is presented to the rabbi of Messina by authorities in the town. His reaction is disdainful and strong, to put it lightly.
Yeah, the rabbi says, "This is the United States of America. This kind of thing doesn't happen. I mean, we Jews came to the United States of America to escape this kind of thing, to escape pogroms and to escape these sorts of crazy accusations." And the rabbi said, "I can't believe that I'm sitting with the mayor and a police official, and this is what you guys are accusing me of." And so that was the question of the book. How was it in a place, in a country where anti-Semitism was really not that terrible, certainly not compared to Europe, how did this terrible accusation surface? And that was the mystery I tried to solve.
Barbara Griffith's disappearance happened about 6 weeks before the presidential election of 1928, in which, of course, New York Governor Al Smith, a storied figure in Democratic politics, was the Democratic candidate, was facing off against Herbert Hoover, longtime Secretary of Commerce at the federal level. How did that kind of hothouse political atmosphere of that fall affect Smith's response to what happened in Messina?
Yeah, so this was one of the most polarizing elections in American history. Herbert Hoover represented that traditional America, the Protestant rural America, and Al Smith, the urban immigrant America. And so it was sort of never the twain shall meet. And everyone knew that Al Smith couldn't win the presidency unless he got New York State's electoral votes. There weren't public opinion polling yet, but that was clear to everybody. And so the political stakes for both the candidates, but especially for Al Smith, were really, really high.
Mm-hmm. So what was his response? How did he kind of step into the action,
the conflict? He stepped right in. He issued a very strong statement condemning this accusation, disassociating anything about New York State from this, and promising to take what action he could against the officials who did this. Smith really played an important role in making clear to the public that this kind of accusation just should never stand in this country.
And it did result in apologies from the public officials who had intimated or kind of leveled the blood libel against the rabbi.
It did. It took a while to extract the apology from the mayor of Messina, but he eventually did. He didn't want to at first.
Without giving away the fate of Barbara Griffiths, which is sort of the suspense element, you know, over the course of your book. The mystery of what happened to her is resolved fairly quickly. Do you ever wonder, as you were studying all the records of this incident, what potentially would have happened if she had remained missing for weeks, months, and so on?
It's a real concern. If this girl had just disappeared for good, without a trace, it could have been really bad. And in fact, several of the elderly Messina residents I interviewed said that there were Jews who thought there was going to be a pogrom.
You know, there are two ways of looking at the resolution of the Messina incident. That it did result, as we've discussed, in apologies in the state government, public officials coming forward and demanding that this insult, this accusation, be lifted and made good. Or, you know, on the other side, the idea that it exposed ignorance, prejudice that the community did not know existed previously, and perhaps never fully came to a reckoning with after the fact. Where do you come down on those kind of two poles of whether this was a good or a bad resolution?
I'm kind of an optimist. And then there was this was a big story in the nation's press, even in the middle of this campaign for a couple of weeks. And most of the commentary in papers all across the country said, this is a medieval thing. It's alien to the United States. It shouldn't happen here, and it must never happen again.
You say that, and yet the blood libel continues to remain as kind of a contagion, not just in the U.S., but kind of around the world.
Absolutely.
To this day.
And you can go to prominent websites in Iran or Egypt, and you find it. And what worries me now is that there are websites in this country, extremist websites, where this sort of rhetoric you see. And what just is a concern in the face of the things that we've been seeing lately, anti-Semitic and other kinds of anti-religious acts, is that this blood libel, which still circulates widely, could resurface in this country and other places.
New York State has one of the most complex court systems in the nation. Judicial officials are looking to consolidate it. They released a plan last month that would reduce 11 different trial courts to just 3. And they say it would save litigants millions of dollars. Lawmakers held 2 hearings on the issue last month, where New York's chief administrative judge, Lawrence Marks, advocated for the plan. I recently sat down with Judge Marks to talk to him about it. New York's Chief Administrative Judge Lawrence Marks, welcome to New York Now.
Thank you.
Well, dispensing justice to 19 and a half million people spread over 55,000 square miles was always going to be tough. But in digging into the background of law reform and justice reform, it seems like the proposals for streamlining the structure of the courts have been around for decades, not just recently. It's an old issue, isn't it?
It's not a new issue. You know, the last 5 or 6 chief judges of the state have tried to change the system, to get approval in the legislature to change the system. Prior governors have tried to do it, so this is not a new proposal.
You've called the existing system unnecessarily complex. Aren't these courts doing the jobs that they were created to do?
They are, but the difficulty for us, I mean, think of the court system as a large business, which it really is. I mean, we don't obviously exist to make a profit, but it's a large business. We're present in all 62 counties of the state, in over 300 courthouses. We have 15,000 or so employees. We have 12 to 1,300 judges. That doesn't include another 1,800 town and village judges who are actually not part of our proposal. But it's an incredibly complex system, and it requires good management. You know, the business that we do is we resolve cases, people's cases and controversies. And we try to do that as fairly and expeditiously as possible. And with this complexity and proliferation of courts, trial courts, it makes it much more difficult for us As the managers of the state court system, this big business that it is, it makes it much more difficult for us to move resources around quickly and efficiently to where they're most needed.
A lot of the proposals have as part of their argument that this would save money. But if you're merely folding courts into each other and not shutting them down, how does that save money?
Well, that's a good question. There are really two parts to that question. Would it save the court system money, as a whole? And the answer to that is no. In fact, we've done an analysis, and it would cost $13 million to implement this proposal, mainly because we would be taking judges in other courts and putting them into the Supreme Court, where the salary is modestly higher, and some of the staff salaries, the judges' personal staff and the court staff salaries, would rise also. But we have a $3 billion budget. A $13 million additional cost is less than one half of 1% of our budget. So relatively speaking, that's a modest cost. Where there are cost savings, however, are to the litigants, where delay and going back to court time and time again without getting the case resolved obviously costs litigants money. That costs them extra attorney's fees. It costs them money because they lose days at work. They may have child care costs, their transportation costs. So by making the court system more efficient, which will allow for faster resolution of cases and fewer court appearances and the necessity to come to court as many times, that will obviously save the litigants a substantial amount of money.
Some of the distinct courts that would go away include the family court, the surrogates court, the court of claims. In some of these courts, there are people with experience that's highly specialized because of the kind of cases they deal with. If you fold the courts into each other, will you be frittering away some of the value of some of that experience?
We actually wouldn't, although by merging these other courts into this consolidated Supreme Court, all of the judges would be qualified and available to handle any and all of the cases. And that's where we feel that there can be great efficiency returns. But of course, individual judges have their own individual experience and expertise. And we would take advantage of that because we would, although, as I said, they would all have full jurisdiction and authority to handle any of the cases that would come to this consolidated court. We would set up divisions, particularly in the higher volume jurisdictions. We would set up specialized divisions, a criminal division, a family division, a commercial division, a probate division. And we would, where we have judges with particular expertise in those areas, we would more likely than not be assigning those judges to those particular divisions.
Let's talk a little bit about mechanics. Earlier in New York history, when big reforms have been passed like this, it required amendment to the state constitution. Can you do this, something this big and this thorough, without amending the state constitution? And how would you propose doing it?
This absolutely requires an amendment of the state constitution. These are fundamental, foundational changes in how our court system is structured in the state. That involves, of necessity, amending the Constitution. We've started that process. To amend the Constitution in New York is not a simple thing to do. It's a cumbersome process. It requires passage of the proposed constitutional amendments by two successive legislatures. And then if there is second passage in the legislature, then the amendments go on the ballot for approval by the voters. So it's not something that can happen quickly or easily, but we've already started that process and are looking forward to and doing everything we can to ensure that we see first passage in the upcoming legislative session that will start in January.
Chief Administrative Judge of the State of New York, Lawrence Marks, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure.
All right, and now for analysis of the week's news, we're at the Reporters Roundtable, where I'm happy to be joined by Bernadette Hogan from the New York Post and Dan Clark from the New York Law Journal. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks.
So over the course of the last week, since last we sat at this roundtable, there have been two more announcements from Senate Republicans announcing that they will not run for re-election. Over the course of the last 7 days, it's from Western New York, Mike Ranzenhofer, and Joe Robach, who has been in the legislature since the early 90s.
And John Flanagan, the Senate Majority Leader, told reporters this week that he had had conversations with people possibly about the re-election in the past couple of weeks. So I don't think it'll be a surprise if we see in the next few weeks more announcements of retirements. What that looks like, it'll depend on whether those districts will be solidly Republican or whether it's something that Democrats can actually fight to take control of.
Right, and depending on how you count it, that's technically seven if you're not counting the Kathy Young seat that, you know, Kathy Young, she vacated the seat last year, so that technically it's eight. However, you have two Republicans, Chris Jacobs and Robert Ort, who are running for Congress. Now, Ort refuses to commit to what he's going to do, whether or not he gets the congressional nomination or the Republican nomination for the seat, or and if he will seek re-election for a Senate seat afterwards. But Chris Jacobs, he will not be seeking re-election for sure. So it's a pretty big number. That's a third of the Republican conference right now.
I mean, what does this mean for kind of the morale within the GOP conference? It's sort of like being on a, it's almost like being on a ship where everybody's jumping overboard.
They've been in control for so long that I feel like going into the minority this year was such a huge change for them. They realized that any big ideas that they put forward, it's not going to happen. There are no compromises here. There's no edging on this. Democrats are not going to concede to their ideas. And I think they got a taste of what they were giving to Democrats all of these years, and that was very discouraging for them.
Right. And it's not as fun to be in the minority as it is to be in the majority.
And Nick Langworthy, the GOP, state GOP chair, has said, no, this is a real opportunity for us to bring in, you know, young, vigorous talent. That's polishing it, I believe,
right,
a little bit.
And to be fair, there were some Republican victories in the November elections, but those were not, there was one state Senate seat that was, of course, the Kathy Young seat, that was won by a Republican, and then a couple other, you know, local races, but they're really going to be looking ahead to a building year.
We now move to what we might call lawsuit corner, a lot of litigation news this week. The first is the challenge against Exxon that was launched by former Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, but carried forward by Tish James, who currently holds that seat, found that Exxon did not deceive shareholders about the potential impacts of climate change.
Right, just in case the viewers don't know about this litigation, basically what the AG's office was alleging is that the ExxonMobil did not prepare for climate change and did not inform its investors that climate change would be affecting its profits. That's basically what they were alleging. Tish James, this is a major loss for her office within the first year of her being in office. This was a huge lawsuit. They did a lot of publicity about it when they filed it. And over the course of several filings, including last year when it was first brought, this has been a multi-year investigation, as you said, launched by Eric Schneiderman. This is one of the biggest environmental cases they had, and it just ended. And we haven't seen any indication that they're going to appeal it.
We mentioned at the top of the show that the Federal Department of Justice had weighed in on the lawsuit brought against the Green Light Law, which will provide driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants. This case brought by Frank Merola, who is a county clerk from up here in Rensselaer County. The DOJ says that the Green Light Law is faulty.
Right. So as of now, unless the judge makes a decision today, the Green Light Law will go into effect tomorrow.
We're talking Friday. And
right, yeah. Friday. And so it will go into effect Saturday the 14th. However, the DMV is not open until Monday. But that being said, DOJ did weigh in and said that certain aspects of the law are legally suspect, which Merola took as a good sign for whether or not the judge rules in his favor or
And one more interesting suit, this one brought by the Government Justice Center with backing from some Capital Region area libertarians, challenging the raises that were approved in early April, that is during the budget negotiation season, not to put too fine a point on it, that would greatly increase, I think it's fair to say, the salaries of Governor Andrew Cuomo and Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul.
This is really interesting to me. I had never considered it. Their argument is that part of the state constitution says that the governor and the lieutenant governor cannot get a pay raise midterm. So if the state legislature approves a raise, it would take effect when the next governor or, you know, the next term of that governor takes effect. So the Government Justice Center is saying that the legislature unlawfully approved these raises, and also Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli, who doles out this money, has been illegally giving the governor and the lieutenant governor all of this money. So it'll be so interesting to see whether that part of the state constitution actually applies and if these raises are struck down.
Right, and it does circle back to what kind of power these faceless commissions do have and the problems that are seen down the road. We've seen it with public campaign financing, and of course we had the precedent last year with the pay raises. So it'll be very fascinating to see what happens.
All right, well, that's where we're going to have to leave it. So thanks very much to Bernadette Hogan from the New York Post and Dan Clark from the New York Law Journal.
Thanks.
Thanks.
To learn more about what we covered on tonight's show, head over to New York Now's website at nynow.org. Until next week, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is New York Now.